Okay, this hour we're going to take your phone calls. Les Klinger, our guest, in the shadow of Edgar Allan Poe. Welcome back to Coast, Les Klinger with us, in the shadow of Edgar Allan Poe. That's his work. You know, we have, right before Halloween this year, Friday, we're going to have our annual Ghost to Ghost show, Les. People like being scared.
Yes.
How come? What is it about the humankind?
Well, my theory, and I'm sure that psychologists will tell me that I'm wrong, but my theory is that it's about practice. It's the same theory that I have about dreaming. Why do we have nightmares? We're rehearsing how we're going to handle the real thing when it comes along. And this is a very controlled experiment. We can always close the book. We can always shut off the television. So it's a great way to practice.
Practice makes perfect, doesn't it?
Sometimes. I mean, I wouldn't want to actually have the real thing of some of these things happen. Huh. But it's good to practice.
Are many of these made into little movies or
sure.
TV shows?
Yes. Some of them, of course, have been on some of the famous anthology shows, Outer Limits, Twilight Zone, and so on. And I think it's really sad that television has gotten away from that.
I do, too.
I love those anthologies. But today, it's the domain, because filmmaking has gotten much easier, we see a lot of independent filmmakers who make short films out of some of these great stories.
And cheap, too.
Yes.
I mean, it's just amazing what some of them have been able to do.
There is actually several annual Lovecraft film festivals, which are not strictly all Lovecraft films, based on Lovecraft stories. Many of the films, the short films in that, are based on Poe and some of the other great horror writers.
When you look at some of the work that Edgar Allan Poe put together, was he very prolific? Did
yes.
they just keep coming?
Yes. And, of course, he was also a poet as well as a short story writer. And he was really the first to try and make a living out of being a writer. He didn't do very well with it, but he was certainly, he didn't fail because of lack of effort. He had a number of volumes of poetry, he had prose, he was editing magazines, as I said, and eventually he did achieve some success. It was hardly instant. I mean, The Raven, when he finally published The Raven, I mean, who has not read The Raven?
Yeah.
But he was 36. He would only live four more years after that. And that was really finally the sort of great public recognition of his work.
Was he frustrated as a writer?
Oh, I think so. I think he thought that he deserved a lot better recognition than he ever got. He didn't feel that he was appreciated here. So I'm sure he was very frustrated.
All right, let's take some calls here. Let's go to our first-time caller, Stephen, in Eugene, Oregon. Hi, Stephen. Go ahead, sir.
Evening, gentlemen.
Yes, hi.
Love all those stories. Been reading them since I was a kid. And in the spirit of Lovecraft and the election season, vote Cthulhu. Why settle for the lesser evil?
There you go.
but I was curious if you'd ever read any Hodgson, William Hope Hodgson.
Yeah.
Was particularly, yes, the Nightland and the sea stories, especially the boats of the Glen Carrig. Wonderful, wonderful.
Yes. I mean, this anthology
stories.
Could have been 100 stories, but publishers don't like anthologies that size. So we sharply limited it, and there's many, many other writers that could have included Hodgson, certainly among them.
Was it always the last moment of this short story that got you?
Well, yes, because what we're trying to, as I said, Poe is striving for, certainly Poe and many of these other writers, sort of building the mood and then finally letting you see what's going on. Lovecraft described the great horror stories as being hoaxes. What he meant was they have to be 99% credible. The 1% can be that supernatural element, and so you try and build it as a prosaic, everyday story that suddenly takes a twist. And the twist, of course, probably goes at the end.
Yeah, he wanted reality mixed into this incredible ending, didn't he?
Yes. And Poe's are very much the same. I mean, you know, who can read The Pit and the Pendulum without seeing how you do that? You know, that here's a story that turns on a dime in the last sentence.
Did the style of the writings change less over the years from the 1800s into the 1900s?
Yes, I think in the 1800s we have a more leisurely style, and as I said, we don't have the short story nearly as popular. The short story is a 19th century phenomenon. There were some in the 18th century, but they didn't really become popular until the 19th century.
Did Reader's Digest pick up any of these during those days?
The equivalent, yes, there were certainly magazines, but again, I mentioned a couple of the titles. There were a number of magazines, and they aimed at different audiences. I mean, there were household magazines, there were children's magazines, and there were magazines aimed at the average person reading fiction for pleasure.
Jay is in Ohio. Welcome to the program, Jay. Good morning.
How are you doing?
Okay.
I just got to say, first of all, my favorite Poe story has got to be the Fall of the House Usher. I don't think it gets nearly enough recognition. But my question to you is a lot of there's been some thought on that Poe's legacy was kind of tainted by some people who were left alive after him, who had kind of a bone to pick with him, some editors and people who were competitors at other magazines and stuff. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think there's some truth to that. He really did not achieve American celebrity until well after his death. He really it really burned him during his lifetime that he wasn't getting that recognition. It's sad that it took the Europeans to discover him, mainly the French. That when Baudelaire translated his work into French and he became the rage in France, it translated into American influence much later in the century.
This disappointment at not getting that instant recognition, the money, did it haunt him?
It certainly had an effect on his career decisions. So I think, yes. I mean, he was disturbed, and some psychologists would read that disillusionment in his stories. There aren't a lot of happy people in his stories.
Because he wasn't happy.
Right.
It really echoed the author.
Write what you know.
Mm-hmm. In terms of these incredible endings, because he had Hitchcockian-type endings, how did he do that? What do you think?
You know, genius, I guess, is the simple answer. But it was a deliberate approach. It was an idea that you should, as I've said several times, that you should be building the mood, aiming for a specific effect. And so I think these were very meticulously edited, very carefully crafted stories that were building to that moment. So, I mean, it was quite intentional.
Did he feel that he had competition for many of these writers that you've looked at in the book, In the Shadow of Edgar Allan Poe?
I don't think so. I mean, very few of them were actually literally his contemporaries. And while he greatly admired Hoffman, who I mentioned earlier, I mean, Hoffman died when he was much younger, when Poe was much younger. And so, no, these were not competitors to him. He wasn't trying to outdo them. He was just trying to perfect his own writing.
If somebody wrote a short story for the magazine of the time, what do you think they got paid for that?
Oh, very little. Very little. You know, they might get $10, $20, something like that.
Which would be the equivalent of what today?
Well,
a couple thousand?
Probably not even that. Depends on the length of the work. I mean, some of them were getting, you know, really very little, but the fees were certainly not enough to make a living. I'm not sure what the amounts were that Poe was getting paid, but they were pittances. I mean, if we shoot forward to Lovecraft and learn that he was selling stories for $25, $35, dollars in the 1930s. Project back, Poe was not well paid either.
So they weren't writing for money, were they?
No, they were not.
It was love.
Poe was trying. Poe was trying to make a living at it, but the market wasn't there.
It wasn't there for that, no. And in terms of newspapers, did any of them do anything syndicated?
Well, yes. I mean, a lot of these, well, first of all, in America, we had the wonderful situation that European writers were routinely syndicated, as we'd say. The stories would appear in multiple newspapers, and they didn't get paid anything.
They just took the story.
Just took them.
Yeah.
They pirated them. So in America, you could sell a story, however, to a chain of newspapers and have it appear in multiple places. So there was some of that going on, but not for the Europeans.
Let's go to Al, truck driving in Nevada. Al, you're up.
How you doing?
Okay.
Well, I don't have a comment on any of Alan Poe's books, but I do have a question about the bottle of cognac, if that was salt. And it also seems like not only did Poe's influences writers, but I believe Alan Parsons wrote an album or a song called The Raven pertaining to Alan
yep.
Poe. Whoever can answer that.
Sure did. And sure, what was his favorite drink? Was it cognac?
That's certainly what it's said to have been, yes. I never got to drink with him, so I can't say what he would have offered. But and of course, you know, numerous films based on Poe's work, and in many cases, like Lovecraft, films that simply borrowed the title and then went on to make their own stories up.
I mean, we studied Poe in our English classes in high school, and I was mesmerized by the guy. I mean, those short stories. The horror stories, the endings. I mean, I love that stuff.
It was great stuff. They're just gem-like. He was a great writer, and he was thoughtful about writing in general. I mean, he was probably best known, interestingly, during his career as a critic more than a writer, as an editor of a magazine, as a critic. And he was well-regarded in that respect. It wasn't his own writing that got attention until, as I said, till the end of the 19th century.
Guy, Texas, we go. John's with us. Hi, John. Go ahead, sir.
Yes, sir. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I'm a lover of Poe for many years. I read Poe when I was very young. Murders in the Rue Morgue and The Telltale Heart has got to be my favorite. But I was wondering, what would your take be on O. Henry? He had several stories that were, he was known for his twist at the end, as in Gift of the Magi, and he wrote some very poignant stuff, like Road to Destiny was one of my favorites.
Certainly, there were other great short story writers out there, in Bret Hart, Mark Twain, and O. Henry, and later a writer known as Saki, who were very successful short story writers. They did not, with the exception of a few stories, they did not generally write horror fiction or these kinds of dark tales. O. Henry's stories are much more sort of Norman Rockwell almost. In being uplifting and heartwarming stories about people.
How did you pick the individuals and the stories that you put into this book?
Wow. You know, there was a certain amount of dart throwing, only because my list was so long of the stories that I love and that I wanted to include. Some of them were easy in the sense that I definitely knew I wanted to include Stoker and Doyle and Le Fanu, only because people know them for other works, and I wanted to show some of their versatility. In the case of a couple of them, they're known in other fields. Dick Donovan, I mentioned, who's best known as a mystery writer. And then within them, I mean, I read a lot of their stories and sort of picked the ones that struck me. I was trying to go for stories that weren't ones that everybody knew. I didn't want to have all the commonly anthologized stories, but some of them were unavoidable. The Yellow Wallpaper has now been in a lot of collections, but it's such a brilliant story. I just had to include it.
Let's take a few more calls before the break, and then we'll come back with some final calls with our special guest, Les Klinger. His website linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. Let's go out to Honolulu in Hawaii. Hello, Rudy. Good morning to you.
How are you doing today?
Good, Rudy. Thank you.
The reason I'm calling is I don't hear him talk very much about the Edgar Allan Poe's The Strange Adventures of Arthur Gordon Pym.
Oh, well. Wow.
What's that do for us, Les?
Well, so Pym is a fascinating story because it's viewed as you pushed my button on that one. It's a prequel in many ways to Lovecraft's brilliant masterpiece called At the Mountains of Madness. It's a story about a man journeying down to the up to the North Pole and seeking the unknown, and Lovecraft ran with it and gave us the South Pole and took it even further. But clearly he knew the Pym story, and the Pym story doesn't get widely read anymore. It was very popular among Poe's work of the 19th century, and actually another sequel to it was written by Jules Verne.
Huh. When Poe died, was there a vacuum there? In terms of other writers, did anybody step in to replace him?
Well, certainly there was a vacuum on the mystery side. Poe, we haven't really talked much about that, and that's really, as I said, a sort of a whole other conversation about Poe as the father of the mystery short story.
Right, right.
But on the mystery side, there was a long gap. On the horror side, we had these other writers who took up the mantle, and many of them, I think, were influenced by Poe directly. Many of them simply came to the same ideas that Poe did and began to write this. So, no, there wasn't really a vacuum. I mean, we can see Poe stands head and shoulders above the other writers, but there was a great deal of this kind of writing in the 19th century.
Must have been exciting times to be around then and really see some quality writing pop out, huh?
I think, you know, we all wring our hands about the golden age being in the past. There's some really quality writing being done right now. There's some brilliant writers of both long and short horror fiction. I'm proud to be the treasurer of the Horror Writers Association.
Good for you.
It's an amazing collection of modern writers.
Great cover, by the way, in this book, In the Shadow of Edgar Allan Poe.
I take no credit for that. The brilliant people at Pegasus Books
did a great
put together
job.
An amazing cover.
And the feeling of that book cover is amazing, isn't it?
Yes, it's almost like spooky velvet.
Yeah, it really is. All right, stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment with Les Klinger. We'll take some final calls before we go into open lines about Edgar Allan Poe, about some of the other incredible authors of the day, and your favorite short horror stories. Well, you're looking for something to do this weekend? Try paranormaldate.com. That's right. Have some fun and meet some people of like minds and interests. Just go to the website. Free to sign up. Go to paranormaldate.com. Okay, welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Les Klinger, and a whole bank of phone calls, Les, so let's get right to them. We go to Madison, Wisconsin. Jim, welcome to the program. Thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Good morning, sirs.
Hi, Jim.
I'm a big fan of Victorian ghost tales, and one of my favorite authors is a guy named Oliver Onions, who wrote the Beckoning Fair one.
Don't know it.
I'm writing this down.
Well,
that's one you ought to check out. Oliver Onions is the author's name. Victorian ghost tale writer. My favorite one of his is called The Beckoning Fair One, although there is an anthology of a collection of his works as well. And if you're a fan of Victorian tales, I'm sure you'd enjoy it.
Great. Thank you.
You betcha.
There must be thousands of other writers out there, Les,
yes,
that are very talented.
Yes, and I'm not ashamed to say I haven't read them all.
No, nope, you can't read them all. You'd be reading forever.
Yes. How great would that be?
So where are we with reading today? I mean, aren't book sales down? Isn't reading down compared to years ago?
I think the numbers of books sold per, I mean, they're depressingly low numbers. I think the number still is that the average American buys 2 books a year. That's pretty depressing when you consider that that includes things like how to learn how to operate Windows 10. You know, it's not, we're not talking about just fiction.
Right.
But,
right.
You know, the media have changed, and I'm not worried about reading. Reading is doing just fine. There are tens of thousands of works of fiction published every year, and authors are not making any less than we ever made historically. We're still starving. I think there's still an enormous appetite for good writing and for reading. I see it at conventions and gatherings of writers and readers, that there's that enthusiasm is still there.
We go to Venice, California, one of our nice spots. Bill is with us. Hi, Bill. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Mr. Norrie. Hi.
Hi, Bill.
Good evening out here in West Coast. I wanted to ask your guest if Edgar Allan Poe, what was his influences in regard to writing, such as Henry David Thoreau?
Yes.
Or perhaps Hawthorne?
Well, certainly, I think Hawthorne was likely to be one of his influences, as were the early Romantic poets. He admired Coleridge. He admired Shelley. He certainly knew Frankenstein and works like that as the products of the Romantics. Thoreau's a little after his time, so I don't know that there was much influence there. But, and I also mentioned E.T.A. Hoffmann early in the show. An important early German fantasist that Poe knew and admired.
Let's go to Columbus, Ohio. Robert's turn on Coast to Coast. Hello, Robert. Go ahead.
Hi, George. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Great. Hello, Les.
Hi there.
Great show tonight. Yes, I wanted to know if you've ever seen the statue in Boston of Edgar Allan Poe. It's in a small park, and it's a life-size statue, and it looks like he's walking through the park. There's a large raven, like near his arm, and then there's a like trails of book pages that are his stories.
How wonderful! No, I have not seen
it. It really captures a spooky essence because it's like he's walking through the park and it's surrounded by trees. And I was just there recently and saw that, and I just wondered if you had seen it.
I had not. That's great. I'm going to look for it next time I'm there.
Yeah, it's great.
All right, that's the way to do it. Les, so what's next for you? You're putting together more works, aren't you?
Yes. I'm working on the annotated Frankenstein. That'll come out from Norton in 2017. But much more importantly, George, I'll take a second to tell you about a project I'm working on with Professor Laura Caldwell. It's a collection called Anatomy of Innocence. It's true stories about wrongly incarcerated individuals. It's their own stories told to major thriller writers like Lee Child and Sarah Paretsky and other great writers. This is going to come out from Norton next year. All of the profits would go to the Life After Innocence Project, which works with exonerees to help them reenter society. We're very excited about this book.
Good for you. You're still bullish on writing and books, aren't you?
I love writing. I'm so sorry it took me until I was in my 50s to start writing. And, you know, it's like, wow, why wasn't I mean, writing, I've always written. I'm a lawyer by day. But writing books and articles, and it's just such joy.
One of those old sayings, don't leave your day job?
Right.
Miami, Florida. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Hello, Mr. Norrie.
Hello, Peter. Good to have you with us.
Yes. Nice to talk to you. You know, like I grew up reading Hardy Boys
yes.
And in between waiting for the next Hardy Boys to come out, I would read Rudyard Kipling's.
One of the most prolific and incredible, and no longer thought of as a great writer. It's too bad.
Oh, he was.
A fabulous writer. And, I mean, when I say no longer thought of as a major writer, because I think the material is a little bit dated. He's become non-PC. You know, he was writing at the height of the height of the empire. And he was intensely loyal to England and a supporter of empire. So some of the material is a little dated. I've always wanted to do the annotated Kim, which is just a fantastic book about the experience of the British in India and the experience of the Indians with the British. A very honest and realistic book, I think, in many ways. But Kipling, fortunately, and the good, he was the highest paid writer of the day, but I don't think he gets enough attention anymore.
His classic poem, as far as I'm concerned, If. It's one of the best, isn't it?
Yes. Close friends with Arthur Conan Doyle. There was a small circle of some of these writers. Bram Stoker was actually part of that circle of friends as well.
What motivated Stoker to do Dracula?
Wow. He says it was a nightmare that he had that must have been some bad crab that he ate, or lobster.
Something was bad. Wow.
Something was really bad. He had a nightmare, and but I think that's a facile explanation. I think he was fascinated by folklore. His short story collections, which I said are sort of largely overlooked now, the earliest collections, are all folklore tales. His mother was a consummate storyteller in the family situation, and he liked telling stories. He loved theater, and he loved storytelling.
Well, and that's the art of a lot of these authors. You can tell that they are great storytellers. I mean, these are the kind of folks you want to be out there with a campfire and listen to them, just to listen to them.
Absolutely. I can't imagine. I mean, we've already mentioned Conan Doyle and Kipling, and wow, they were storytellers.
Anderson, South Carolina, it's Charles' turn. Charles, you're up with us on Coast to Coast.
Yeah, well, I've always been a night owl, and George, I absolutely love the show.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate that.
I've always lived in South Carolina, and I grew up in the Low Country, and I became a huge fan of Nancy Roberts. I probably read everything she's ever wrote several times. And I also used to get those Alfred Hitchcock magazines in the mail all the time.
Yes.
I wish I had kept them. They might be worth something right
now.
Well,
they might. And the good news is Alfred Hitchcock Mystery Magazine is still being published. There are two great magazines that both published by the same company. One is called Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine, and the other is called Alfred Hitchcock. And they're still coming out, and they're great.
Nancy Roberts was called the First Lady of American Folklore.
Yeah, she was great. And I wanted to ask you, a few years ago, I saw a documentary probably on the History Channel, and they suggested that Poe might have died of rabies, and I thought, now that would be a weird way for a man like that to check out. And I was wondering if Les had heard that and what you might have thought of it. And
I
think
I had not.
You got it.
I had not. I've heard the other rumor is syphilis, but I don't, you know, we just don't really know.
If he was bitten by a dog, I hope it had red eyes, right?
I hope so, too. Dude, probably the Hound of the Baskerville.
It would be the fitting way.
Of the Hound of the Baskerville.
Yeah, the fitting. Did he have family?
Not for long, no. I mean,
the wife died at 24.
Right.
He died at 40.
Right, and no children. So there was really no family. The cause of his death has been attributed to drinking, brain congestion, drug overdose.
Oh, geez.
Rabies is certainly one of them. Cholera, tuberculosis, nobody knows.
Well, and, well, you know, people didn't live that long in those days anyway.
Well,
did they?
40 was
some
pretty
of
young.
Them.
But
was
you're
young.
Right. I mean, and Lovecraft died at the age of 47. Another sad case, similar in many ways to Poe. We greatly admired Poe. Really wanted to be Edgar Allan Poe. But, you know, writing of this kind and writing with this sort of burning flame, I think, really consumes these kinds of writers.
Before we go to final calls, what are we doing now to create new writers, new Edgar Allan Poes, new Arthur Conan Doyles, new Bram Stokers? What are we doing for that?
I mean, I think I am encouraged to see people in schools still writing and people reading and writing. I just came back. I spent the day at Eastfield College in Mesquite, Texas, talking to students and faculty about Sherlock Holmes and the mystery genre. And, you know, it was interesting to me. One of the students said to me he was embarrassed to tell me that he only read comic books. And I said, be proud. First of all, there are some great writers writing comic books these days. And second, graphic novels have now gotten to be a big deal. You see them on bestseller lists and all that. Another person said they only read manga. And I said, manga is great. They love Sherlock Holmes. They love mysteries and all that. So reading is out there. It's taking many different forms. The schools are still the beacons of literature, and I'm encouraged.
Every time I go back to Detroit, Mom's still in the house that I was 8 years old in, and I tear the place up looking for my baseball cards and my comic books, Les.
I know. My comics, I think, are long gone. Sad to say, twice I've lost collections of comics. Now mine are carefully taken care of. I have Sherlock Holmes, Vampire, Lovecraft, Frankenstein, and other strange comics, but they're well.
I mean, when I was 10, 1960, what kind of comics would I would have had almost like originals, wouldn't I?
Sure, you would have
in
had
those
early
days.
DCs, and then you were at the right time. We're similar ages, George, that we were lucky when the Marvel comics were first coming out,
yeah.
Spider-Man and all those. I was in college. I was like, wow, these are great things.
Remember Archie?
Of course.
Is he still out there?
Still out there. There's a wonderful crossover comic out there now, too, called Archie versus Predator.
Let's go to Kat in Atlanta, Georgia. Kat, thanks for calling. Go ahead. Hi, Kat.
Good morning. I'm in the process of reading the letters of Flannery O'Connor from the archives of Emory University.
Okay.
And in those letters to Betty Hester, she writes that she had she read very little of the great writers before she went to college, but she was able, from the limited library of Milledgeville, Georgia at that time, to obtain and read the humorous stories of Edgar Allan Poe. And I'd like you to speak about Poe's humorous stories. The stories that she mentioned was a man too vain to wear glasses and he falls in love with his grandmother. O'Connor says she thought he was drunk when he wrote it, so I wasn't able to find anything about
that. I loved my grandmothers, but not that way. Put the glasses
on.
I must say,
I don't know anything about Poe's humor writing. I don't know that there is much of it. Some of the stories are bizarre, and they're almost comical in that respect. But I don't think he ever thought of himself as a humorist.
What did you think, and what do you think, of Stephen King and some of his short stories?
I love Stephen King's writing.
Is he like the Edgar Allan Poe of today?
I don't think so. I think he's not trying to do that. I mean, first of all, I don't think, I mean, while he has written many short stories and he's quite good at it, he doesn't really, he wouldn't hold himself out as that being his big thing. It's not what he likes to do. And I think he is more interested in character than Poe ever was. And I think also King's writing, especially in the
But scary.
There's a certain nostalgia.
That it too. Thing with that clown with the file teeth, I didn't like that.
Peter Straub is a wonderful writer of horror as well. And both of them have, I think, a great deal of nostalgia elements in their story, too, about what we've lost with urban environments and the loss of small towns and all that. I think probably the greatest proponent of the short story and the scary short story of the 20th century is Ray Bradbury.
Let's go to New Orleans. Edwin's turn on Coast to Coast. Hello, Edwin. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing, George?
Good, Edwin.
My first time calling, so I'm so glad I was able to.
Super.
And right before I got in, you kind of stole my thunder with Stephen King, because that is my favorite author of all time.
He's one of the best.
Stephen King, I eat up. And I kind of actually wanted to bring that out, that I actually thought I was thinking on Stephen King and Edgar Allan Poe about a month ago, and I was thinking, I was like, Stephen King has got to be, you know, the modern-day Edgar Allan Poe,
yeah,
if not for similar writing, but for, you know, just mastery of writing. You know, he is just, you know, he's awesome.
He is spot on, to be sure. I've been trying to get him less on the show. If I ever do, I'll get you on with me, and we'll chat with him.
I've talked to him a few times, and we have many interests in common. I mean, he loves Lovecraft, he loves Dracula, he loves Sherlock Holmes, and I've been trying to get him to write a story for me for our anthologies of Sherlock Holmes stories, but he's a busy guy.
Wally is in Wilmington, Delaware. Wally, got about a minute for you, but go ahead.
Yeah, okay. I recite the Raven every year at the Deer Park Hotel.
Perfect.
In Delaware.
Wonderful. It was the first piece of poetry that I was forced to memorize when I was a kid. But amazingly, it didn't take anything away from it, even though it was forced.
Well, I have a sort of a cult following down there.
Good for you.
Been doing this for about 20 years.
It's one of those things that just works really well read aloud.
Yeah, it really does. And then the reaction of people after you read it, that's fantastic. I hope young people get a chance to really witness the great works of the Edgar Allan Poes and the so many people that you've illustrated in the shadow of Edgar Allan Poe. I hope the schools are still teaching them. Are they?
I'm sure they're teaching Poe. I'm not sure that we're getting readers to look beyond Poe. And it would be nice to imagine that schools might buy this book and use it as a text.
That would be nice.
But I think that's not yet going to happen. Poe has made it into the official pantheon of great American writers, and most of these have not yet reach that level of achievement.
You stay in touch with us, my friend. We'll be back in a moment with Open Lines Now on Coast to Coast. Plus, I want you to react if you think we are in end times. We'll be back.